Thank you very much, Ralph, for those very kind remarks. And good morning, everyone. This is quite a group, and I hope those of you who are standing will see that there are some seats up front. Before we get too serious, I want to share a lighthearted tale that describes the challenges involved in pursuing a different course and in bringing about change, especially in the fields of science, engineering, and technology. A synthetic biologist and a social scientist await death at the hands of an executioner. The executioner asks the social scientist if he has a final wish. Yes, he says, I have some new findings on the societal and ethical dimensions of synthetic biology, and I want to present them to the scientific community before I die. The executioner then turns to the synthetic biologist and asks if she has a final wish. Yes, she said, just shoot me before I have to listen to that lecture. I'm certain that those of us gathered here today have no such sentiments about the broad issues that this symposium will address. We know that contemporary research at the frontier is characterized by how it draws on and contributes to advances in many fields of science and engineering. We also know that research and discovery move forward within the context of society's larger goals and values. Over the past several years, reports and commentary on synthetic biology have proliferated. They raise important issues and catalog both the promise and the potential peril of this emerging field. As in most transformative fields, we can already glimpse the promise that is to come. At the same time, uncertainty about potential impacts gives us pause. Many feel a sense of urgency in this tension between benefits and risks of emerging technologies. Balancing both is a difficult challenge, even for quite simple choices. In the case of emerging technologies that are very complex, we require sophisticated and subtle solutions, the very best we can devise. This is an arena in which science and policy should work hand in glove, but very often don't. The nexus between science and engineering and policy is not a new subject, but more urgent today as technology penetrates every aspect of our lives. In the words of one technology scholar, it's a challenge to understand how intelligent social decisions can be made in the face of great uncertainty, high complexity, and rampant disagreement. None of us wants to be caught between a doomsday Scylla and a utopian Charybdis. You will hear from many experts in science, engineering, and policy over the course of this symposium that will shed some light on what we can do to facilitate sound decision-making. Supporting emerging areas of research is central to the business of the National Science Foundation. We call such embryonic fields transformative because they hold great potential for advancing knowledge and providing benefits to society. The term transformative describes science and engineering endeavors that can revolutionize research thinking, create entirely new fields, disrupt accepted theories and perspectives, and destabilize markets. Over the years, that commitment has led NSF to encourage the fundamental and catalytic research underpinning and leading to advances in biotechnology, computer and communications technologies, and more recently, nanotechnology and synthetic biology, the subject of our discussions here today. NSF also has a firm commitment to weave social science and environmental studies into research projects involving emerging technologies. Dr. Endy and Dr. Rabinow, whom you will hear from shortly, are both associated with SNBERC, the NSF-supported Synthetic Biology Engineering Research Center. Studies of human practices were integrated into the center program right from the very start. The NSF Center for Nanotechnology and Society at Arizona State University helped pioneer this integrative approach several years ago. Indeed, we have an extensive research program in the social, environmental, and safety aspects of nanotechnology. Last year, NSF funded two new centers for exploring the environmental implications of nano. NSF also supports fundamental research on decision-making, risk, and uncertainty to gain insight into decision-making processes, loss and mitigation models, and risk perception. This work helps us manage the risks and general governance associated with emerging technologies, including synthetic biology. We often work jointly with mission agencies that have a regulatory responsibility when fundamental research will enhance the ability to carry out their missions. These activities in fundamental research also serve as catalysts for the education and training of the next generation of researchers, as well as in the development of a science and technology workforce. Transformative research today demands not only innovative concepts, but creative and fresh approaches to generating ideas. I'll only mention the recent Ideas Factory sandpit on synthetic biology that NSF jointly sponsored with the UK research councils. The exercise produced truly visionary projects and a number of potential collaborations among UK and US researchers. Innovative concepts are the sine qua non of scientific progress. We now recognize, in addition, that exploration of safety, security, environmental, and social implications must be undertaken coincident with investigations to advance the science leading to the development of emerging technologies. This recognition is an important step in establishing science and technology policy that is appropriate to the science and responsive to the values of our societies. But it is only a first step. The path is steep, and we have some arduous climbing yet to undertake. The pace of discovery and commercialization today is both swift and critical to global prosperity. We need totally new paths to develop a policy framework that is appropriate to the new realities of our technology-intensive world. No one wants to forego the potential benefits, and no one wants to ignore the potential perils of new technology. Yogi Berra once said, a great scientific mind, the future ain't what it used to be. Of course, he also said, I didn't say most of the things I said. Certainly we can say today that science ain't what it used to be. And I would add, it isn't what it will become in the years ahead. Nonetheless, there are some features that characterize the current context of science and engineering that have consequences for our discussions today. The changing context of research requires some rethinking of our present path and some innovative responses. First, we now have a much deeper understanding of complexity, and particularly of complex systems. This gives us a deeper understanding of technology. Current policy discussion should reflect this contemporary reality. IPCC climate change assessment products are an example of how this can work from the science side. We need energetic efforts to ensure our emerging technologies are thoroughly understood in a holistic context. This brings me to a second feature of contemporary science. Modeling and simulation provide powerful new tools for exploring consequences. Modeling and simulation not only provide improved methods for testing hypotheses and theories, they enhance our ability to anticipate future developments as we design public policy. In this way, science can better inform the policy dialogue in ways that were literally impossible only decades ago. Again, climate science is a leading example. The construction of scenarios using not only physical variables, but economic and social ones as well, is a sophisticated approach to a very complex predicament. A third feature of contemporary research involves the social sciences. Our understanding of human and social dimensions, as well as the mechanisms of learning, have progressed rapidly in recent years. In fact, with today's computer and communication tools, There is every reason to believe that the social sciences are poised to accelerate progress in many research areas. Despite this ripeness, funding and support has been woefully inadequate. I've already mentioned the involvement of the social scientists in synthetic biology research, a path many governments are following. This is a vital point, so I'd like to elaborate. Just consider what the demand is for social scientists these days. Economists are asked to provide policy guidance and make forecasts for national and global economies. When we ask what is wrong in today's schools, we turn with frustration to studies in learning and cognition, and we expect immediate answers. When disasters like Hurricane Katrina occur, we expect disaster management plans to reflect sophisticated knowledge of human behavior. And we have only just begun to consider human responses to climate change. As we design policies for mitigation and adaptation, we need to know, at the very least, how people and the market will react to incentives and to education about energy alternatives. We need a very aggressive research agenda to answer all of these questions and many more. The agenda for synthetic biology will differ in details, but the principle is the same. Technology is created and used by human beings. And without a thorough understanding of humans, of our institutions, we have at best only a partial understanding of the technology. With synthetic biology, we have an opportunity to get this right from the outset, but not without a firm commitment to integrate the social, behavioral, cognitive, and economic sciences into our research agenda. Without this input, it would be difficult indeed to adequately explore environmental, health, safety, and security issues. Government funding agencies can help make this happen. Thanks to progress in many fields of science and engineering, we now have the improved tools to inform decisions and policy, but what more do we need? Many years ago, the British mathematician and biologist Jacob Bernoulli wrote a slim book. He wrote several slim books, and they're all very powerful. This one was entitled Science and Human Values. Among many wise observations, he wrote, "Tolerance among scientists cannot be based on indifference. It must be based on respect. The same holds true for scientists, decision makers, and the public. At the very least, tolerance means listening attentively to each other. Tolerance also means respecting the public's perception of an emerging technology, even when we disagree. Tolerance does not mean displaying indifference to genuine concerns by getting ahead of the public on these issues. Democratic ideals and values can be at risk in an increasingly technological society when we do not educate and fully engage citizens in dialogue on critical issues. In this respect, synthetic biology and other emerging technologies are no different than many other social issues. The challenge today, however, is that our societies are infused with technologies that are at once complex and ubiquitous. That makes a dialogue about science and technology much more difficult, but also immensely much more important to get right. At a minimum, we need a clear statement of the science. Although this seems obvious, science that is accessible to policymakers and the broader public is in short supply. Communicating science is a very complex endeavor, but one we must work to achieve. We also need an analysis of possible policy options and a transparent decision. In the U.S., President Obama not only embraced a science-based policy, but has made greater transparency and accountability an overarching goal as well. Engaging citizens in genuine dialogue is the essential final ingredient, yet one that presents enormous challenges. Just consider a recent public opinion survey on energy issues conducted by Public Agenda, a survey organization. The survey revealed that 51% of those surveyed could not name a renewable energy source. 39% could not name a fossil fuel. Clearly, there's an urgent need for public education on these issues. Yet, that is not what strikes me as most significant about the survey. Despite a lack of knowledge about energy sources, 3/4 of those surveyed believed that the U.S. should move toward increased use of alternative energy, even if oil prices go down. These strong attitudes are based on something other than knowledge, but they're important to take seriously. Crude as a snapshot may be, it points to a pervasive and serious problem, and one that lies at the heart of broader dialogue on emerging technologies. We need an informed public to arrive at informed decisions. It is a fundamental responsibility of everyone to promote and support science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education at all levels. Without this goal, our decisions will be made exclusively rather than inclusively. We know that pursuing new knowledge and innovation is the best path toward economic prosperity and the solution to persistent societal problems. From energy security to climate change, and from poverty to disease. I believe that synthetic biology can make substantial contributions to the quality of life and prosperity in the years ahead. Our ability to address the most pressing needs of our times depends upon our resolve to pursue a future shaped by scientific vision and leadership. As for broader societal dimensions, I turn to the famous 17th century Japanese swordsman, Miyamoto Musashi, to express this perspective he once wrote. In strategy, it is important to see distant things as if they were close, and to take a distance view of close things. This advice applies to the intersection of science, technology, and policy no less than it does in considering strategy. Although this perspective may sound first like a contradiction, the deeper reality is that we must see emerging technologies from without, which is a citizen standpoint, and we must find a way to help citizens to see it from within, as researchers do. If policy aims to develop the world to which we aspire, science and technology creates the paths by which we realize those aspirations for all of the world's citizens. That puts us all together in the same boat, steering for the future with all its uncertainties and its promises. Thank you.
Dr. Bemet has graciously said that he'd take a question or two from the audience, so if you have any questions, we have microphones on either side of the room, and please come up. Thank you.
I'm curious.
This is a yes. Pause that mystifies. I would think there'd be some questions. Yeah. Yes.
Henry Yang from Beijing, China.
Yes,
I just want to know how much you have funded for synthetic biology and since when? And what's the percentage of your funding from NSF to the total amount?
For synthetic biology?
Yes.
I would have to give a wild stab at that that number. Does someone from NSF have an answer, a specific answer? I would guess that if you took all the dimensions of synthetic biology in the field of biology through the tree of life, but especially at the cellular and molecular level, it's probably of the order of $100 million, roughly, which is pretty significant. Yes, please.
Thanks. The problem of public understanding of science has been remarkably resistant to something that we've been able to make progress on for as long as we've been keeping statistics on science literacy. So another perspective might be that that's just a system condition that we have to accept. Plus, I thought the point that you made about the difference between particular knowledge about particular technologies and general sentiments about what society ought to do was a very important one that's often neglected. So could you just address how we might think differently about the problem of public science literacy, given that we've been rending our hands about this for at least since the time of Sputnik, with almost nothing to show for it in terms of actual statistical progress?
Well, I was in the UK just a short time ago. I met Sir Adrian Smith for the first time. But one of the things that I found, which was most impressive, is the extent to which they have gone to the public through public hearings to raise these issues and get their thoughts and impacts, their attitudes toward the subject. And there's not an emerging technology that exists today that doesn't have a balance of risks and benefits. So it's always going to be a balancing act with the general public, whether the promises outweigh the risks. And that's something scientists shouldn't take together when they're very deeply involved in the science, that there is this balance that has to be attended to. And the public hearings that have been held in the UK on this subject are very impressive. But you don't have to wait for a federal agency to establish a public hearing. You can have every university in the country can certainly bring this subject up and tap public attitudes. And so that's what I would encourage.
Robert Winston, Imperial College London. I was very grateful to hear your last comment about what we're trying to do in the UK. Do you not think that it's about time we stop talking about the public understanding of science? I think that's a misnomer. What the UK experience shows very clearly, that when we have dialogue with the public, there is a hugely wide accord about a large mass of scientific data. It's not merely a question of scientific literacy. It goes to our being able to listen as scientists to what the public are telling us.
Now, that's a very good point, and I take your point. And again, in many of these subjects, because of the complexity of the subject, you're going to have a wide spectrum of opinions and findings by the scientific community itself. So developing a consensus of thought on some of these serious issues, such as the anthropogenic impact of global warming, is an ongoing process. That's part of the scientific method. And, of course, that's the job of skeptics and critics, which we all are. But nevertheless, if there is uncertainty and if there's this wide divergence of views, that, too, ought to be known to the public. And we should fess up that we don't have all the answers.
Andrew Maynard, Woodrow Wilson Center. I was very gratified by your emphasis on citizen engagement and dialogue. But I was interested, I know the NSF have put a lot of resources into developing an understanding of how people respond to different scientific issues and how you might engage with members of the public. But can you say something about the agency's experiences in actually bringing citizens into decision-making processes where science is concerned?
We find that our tools are inadequate at the present time. And one of the missing components is a database or databases that one can draw on in order to do scientific research and analysis. In our Science and Science and Innovation Policy Program, we have now recognized that in very stark terms. So we are now making investments to try and fill in that database that will inform how to inform policymakers and how to put science agencies as well as scientists on the side of being an honest broker.
Paul Rabineau, Berkeley. I hope we'll talk about this a number of times today, but just want to put on the agenda that there's vast illiteracy and ignorance among the scientists, natural scientific community about many, many social, cultural, political, ethical interests, and this is as well as other specialties in the natural sciences. So it's a overly self-laudatory to think the public is stupid, but the scientists know what's going on. Being an anthropologist, I can assure you it's more complicated than that. I'm sure you agree. And that what happened with Sputnik Forward was the American education system was changed. And almost no one has any general education requirements anymore. So one of the classic comments at a lab meeting in Jay Kiesling's lab that I was talking to, I mentioned skepticism, and someone said, "Oh, I took that course at Harvard." That was all you needed to know, and he was more open than most. So I think this is a multi-channeled problem, which absolutely cannot be taken as if the problem's only on one side. I think it's more complicated than that.
Yes, I agree with that point. I think also we have to clarify our questions to the public, especially through surveys. I was taken by this public survey that in some cases you may have to explain what you mean by renewable when you talk about renewable fuels. In some cases you may have to clarify what you mean by fossil when you ask about fossil fuels. In the minds of some, that's the food you feed fossils.
But again, if you were to do a survey of biochemists and ask them about anything of the history of ethics, I think you'd find an even lower percentage of knowledgeable answers.
It's been brought to my attention, and I should have recognized it just this past week from two or three different sources, that the difficulty in bringing the social scientists to some of these problems is that many social scientists are not ready yet to engage in interdisciplinary research. They want to build the basis, the basic foundations of the field. That's where they want to focus their attention. Secondly, our tenure process is inimical to interdisciplinary research. How do you judge a person's value based on integration and convergence and problem solving or application when it comes to tenure review? And what value does the university play? And not the university, but the community within the university. You know, that's the limited partnership called faculty. This is where I think we need some workshops in order to explore those issues. Because, as I indicated, every mission agency in Washington is very much in tune. They want more social science input into the problems that they're dealing with. And they look to the NSF because we have about the only funded program for social scientists in the federal government. So it's more than just building the funding base. It's also building the community base that is interested in engaging. And thank heavens you're an exception, Paul.
Hi. I'm Pam Silver. I'm from Harvard, and I did not teach the course on skepticism, although I remain skeptical. First of all, I want to say that I really admire the NSF for leading the way in funding in synthetic biology. That said, and this is, again, not a question that's going to have a short answer, and maybe it's one for discussion later, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the current mechanisms for giving out federal funds in the U.S. and the level of frustration you might feel or not feel with the current peer review system. And I also refer to the Gina Collada's front page piece in the New York Times, which admittedly only addressed cancer, but those problems run deeper than just cancer funding.
Well, You ask a very important question, but one that's a little difficult to answer, because the system of funding research from the federal government depends specifically on which agency you're referring to and which in which program within an agency, in some respects, you're referring to. But throughout the world, I think there's a growing recognition of the importance of competitive research or competitive proposals, competitive review, competitive and objective review, and the value of the peer review system, the merit review system. Now, we've chased around the block for 50 years as a foundation looking for alternative ways of investing taxpayers' funding, you know, and being good stewards of taxpayers' funds. We have yet to find a better mechanism in general that will...
Okay, well, I'd like to maybe put that on the table for discussion right. later.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Bement. Thank you.